With this string sextet, the opera Capriccio begins. There can be few other operas that start with 12 minutes of chamber music, but then there are few other operas whose form and whose subject are so intimately connected. Capriccio is an opera about opera. The fact that Capriccio begins with a sextet announces from the start that its scope is human, that its scale is conversational, and also that the conversation we're going to hear is as much sensible as sensuous. Capriccio was Richard Strauss's last opera. Because of the accidents of war, it was not the last to be presented on stage, but it was nevertheless his final work for the stage. It was first performed in wartime Munich on October the 28th, 1942, under the baton of the famous conductor Clemens Krauss, who was also responsible for the opera's libretto. We know from the correspondence between composer and librettist that Strauss wanted Capriccio to be his artistic testament, that he saw it very consciously as the fruit of his 45 years of operatic experience. He had begun that experience in 1894 with the super Wagnerian Guntram, and he had thereafter tended to alternate between the grandiloquent and the intimate. Thus, after Rosenkavalier in 1911, with its great length and huge orchestra, there followed Ariadna auf Naxos in 1913, scored for chamber orchestra and only a handful of singers. Thus, after the heroic grandeurs of Die Frau ohne Schatten in 1919, there followed 3 years later Intermezzo, a bourgeois comedy, as Strauss called it, small in scale, almost conversational in style. Throughout his career, of course, he needed to give expression to that side of his genius which leaned towards the grandiose, the vast, the unwieldy. From this side, some of his most successful works are derived, especially Rosenkavalier and Die Frau ohne Schatten, as well, of course, as some of his most uneven, like Die Ägyptische Helena and Die Liebe der Danae. But equally, Strauss felt drawn to the less heroic, to the intimate, the conversational, to what was more human in scale, to what we find in Ariadne and Intermezzo, in Daphne and in Arabella, especially the first act. What Strauss was wrestling with here in this alternation between the vast and the intimate is the eternal, the inescapable problem faced by the opera composer. What is the relative importance of words and music? Words or music, the problem of Wort oder Ton, as we find it expressed in Capriccio. How does the composer strike a balance in which neither predominates at the expense of the other? How does he strike a balance in which the expressive powers of the orchestra are fully deployed, but yet do not overwhelm the text? By means of which, of course, the action exists. Is the Wagnerian synthesis of poetry and music still useful? Or must a new style be found, swifter and lighter in character, a style closer to the more ordinary intercourse of daily life? Can the unending melody of Wagner, on the other hand, be adopted to a new style like this? Such were the questions that occupied Strauss's mind throughout his career. Such were the questions he set out to solve for the last time when he embarked on Capriccio. And as that opening sextet reveals, it was for the more intimate that Strauss opted. The sextet is, in effect, a renunciation of the grandiose. The idea for Capriccio was suggested to Strauss by Stefan Zweig, who directed the composer's attention to an 18th century opera parody by the Abbé Casti, a parody which Salieri had originally composed. In the event, Casti's libretto had nothing to do with the opera that emerged from the collaboration of Strauss and Krauss, but the title of that libretto did. Prima la musica, dopo le parole. First the music, then the words. That alone was enough to provide the impetus, the notional idea which turned into Capriccio. The main lines of the libretto, as we now have it, suggested themselves to the collaborators as an exemplification in human terms of this conflict between Wort und Ton. The Countess, young and beautiful, is wooed by both a poet and a musician, but faced at the last with the necessity of choice, she is unable to decide between them, between, in other words, poetry and music. An ending that, as Strauss realized, brought his operatic career to an end with a question mark. The action of Capriccio takes place in the drawing room of a Rococo castle just outside Paris. The time is that of Gluck's operatic reform, somewhere in the mid-1770s. It is afternoon. The Countess, a young widow, sits off stage in the music room listening to a string sextet composed in honor of her coming birthday by the young Flamand. He and the poet Olivier gaze at her, both with longing. In an armchair, La Roche, the theater director, sits sleeping blissfully. The composer and the poet begin to argue the comparative importance of poetry and music. When the sextet comes to an end, La Roche wakes up, says that soft music is the best soporific, and joins in the argument. Neither poetry nor music, he says, is the greatest of the arts, his own. The art of theatrical production overshadows both and uses them as its servants. He praises, instead, Italian opera. What the theatre needs is sumptuous sets, beautiful women, tunes, arias, opportunities for vocal display, human interest. The Count and Countess return from the music room as Flamand, Olivier and La Roche leave. She is deeply moved. He, on the other hand, feels that music alone does not give him the intellectual stimulation he needs from art. He teases his sister about her interest in Flamand, the composer. She, in turn, brings up the name of the actress Clairon. The Count is to play opposite the great actress in a play by Olivier, written in honor of the Countess's birthday. He admits he loves Clairon, but he praises nonetheless a life of quickly won and quickly lost attachments. The Countess is different. She longs for lasting love. As Olivier, Flamand and La Roche come back into the room, Clairon arrives for the rehearsal. She and the Count begin to read from Olivier's play, and the scene ends with a passionate sonnet. La Roche goes with Clairon and the Count into the adjoining theatre for rehearsal, leaving the Countess alone with her two admirers. Flamand rushes off to another room to set the sonnet to music, and in his absence Olivier pleads his love, but then Flamand returns and plays and sings the newly composed sonnet. Olivier is called to the rehearsal by La Roche. Now it is Flamand's turn to declare his love. The Countess, having heard the sonnet set to music, is confused by her emotions. Was it the sound that moves her heart, or was it the words? The rehearsal over, the participants return. A young dancer, introduced by La Roche, performs for the company. Flamand and Olivier resume their argument of word versus tone. The others join in. The Count ridicules opera, all opera, every kind. And to prove him wrong, La Roche brings in a pair of Italian singers who perform a duet. Then he begins to tell about the spectacle he has planned for the Countess's birthday, a spectacle to represent the birth of Pallas Athene, followed by the destruction of Carthage. Olivier and Flamand make cruel fun of what they consider to be his outmoded ideas, while the Italian singers worry whether they are going to be paid and stuff themselves with food. After a while, it looks as though La Roche's plans are doomed, but when he gets a chance to speak for himself, he bitterly rounds on his attackers. Why isn't their writing for the stage more vital, he asks? Why isn't their music on a grander scale? Why don't they get to work on something worthwhile at last? The Countess takes up his suggestion with enthusiasm and urges Flamand and Olivier to join forces and produce something important, an opera. But an opera not about Ariadne or Daphne or on a Persian or a Roman theme, all that has been done before. The Count suggests they make an opera of everything that has taken place there that day. After agreeing, Flamand, Olivier and La Roche depart. Clairon leaves, accompanied by the Count. The servants begin to tidy up the deserted room. They discuss the guests and their masters. Then the prompter, Monsieur Taupe, who has fallen asleep during the rehearsal, suddenly appears in the gathering darkness. He tells the major domo that in fact he is the most important person in the theatre, because without him the show couldn't go on. But now he has been forgotten by his troupe, and he's far from Paris. The kindly major domo offers him a carriage to take him home. The Countess returns alone. She plays the sonnet on the harp and sings it to herself. Which of the two men does she love? She must tell them the following morning at 11. Thoughtfully, she gazes at herself in the mirror. Her image does not help. She cannot find an answer. She smiles enigmatically. Choice is impossible. And dinner is ready. The majordomo watches her exit, shaking his head in astonishment. The questions raised here by Strauss are clear enough, but the answers, as the indecision of the Countess reveals, don't admit of anything so simple by way of summary. They are like the Countess's final monologue, equivocal, unexpressed in any direct way. But they are implicit in the behaviour of these characters nonetheless, and the success of the opera might be thought to a large extent to depend upon the success with which they have been endowed with life. Human beings need be less explicit, after all, than ideas. They can exemplify so much more than they need either state or even be aware of. But there is a real uncertainty about whether, in fact, the Countess, Olivier, Flamand, and the others are successful embodiments of Strauss's ideas, about whether they are really human beings at all. Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, whose interpretation of the Countess has set a standard for this role in our time, sees Capriccio more as a play of ideas than as an interplay of human beings.
I think people mistake that opera to be something which has really an action. It has not, you know. I think personally that the Countess, as many human traits I'm going to give her and I want to give her, is still the embodiment of an idea and is, so to speak, the muse of a composer and a poet and a theater director and so on, various things in art. As they actually existed in previous times, there were people who really became inspirations and inspirators or inspiratrices to artists. And I do not think personally that Strauss or Krauss have invested the role of the Countess with really very human and psychological traits at all. One can try and make the public believe it, that there are some psychological developments. There is none. It is really the embodiment of it's a symbolic figure, let us say. And that's why, in the end, when the question is still open as to whom she gives her hand to or her heart to the poet or to the composer, it still is the same question as to what comes first, words or music, what is more important. And it's really a question which is very dear to, let us say, our hearts, my heart especially, because, you know, I'm not only singing opera, I'm singing Lieder. And there, that question becomes very, very evident as to what is more important, words or music. And I think for every composer who has composed for singers, for the voice, that question came up very severely at one time or another. And it comes up in every singer's life. And it also comes up quite daily in the opera. For instance, when the public come, and they will perhaps not, I'm sure they won't understand every word. But on the other hand, if you sing an opera in English here, I'm sure 75% of the audience don't understand the words either. So there's the question, what's more important? What speaks to the public more when they hear an opera? The music or the words? Now, in this opera here, Strauss has given very definite, and Krauss, definite directions that one should make the words as clear as possible. And that's what we're trying to do, and that, of course, is mainly the problem of the conductor, to keep the orchestra so transparent that the words at all times will come through. And I think they will in this case. Still, they will not be understood because they will be in German. But I hope that the public will have studied the translation of the libretto a little bit and know what it is all about. And I personally think it will not be a great hindrance because I remember I did that role in Paris in German And we had 24 curtain calls at the end. So the German language cannot have been such a great hindrance at that.
Well, Strauss felt that in this opera he had ended his career with these
yes,
his
I think
words,
it is
question
quite
mark,
definitely his testament, if you take it together with Metamorphosen for the orchestra and the four last songs, and Capriccio, because really the discussion goes around all the subjects which might ever come up on composing, performing, well, anything which has to do with art, with the musical art and with visual art also.
How do you think, then, the Countess differs from the other heroines of Strauss?
Well, the other heroines in Strauss have a definite psychological development and really human reasons and human touches. I speak only of the Rosenkavalier. There's nothing more human in the whole history of opera. And every woman and every man in the audience, be they young, middle-aged or old, see themselves embodied on the stage, which is not the case in this opera. There is, I don't think, anybody in the audience who can see themselves there embodied by somebody on the stage, because it is ideas who are being embodied on the stage, not persons.
What about the later Strauss operas? Let's say even a later von Hofmannsthal opera, Ariadne.
It comes in between, because that has very, very human traits and sentiments and developments, but is lit over, I don't know how to say that in English very well, by some marvelous philosophical observances on human nature, on art, on many other things, but it still has a very human background.
And the even later, the Gregor opera, say Daphne, for example, the relationship between the heroine in
that's,
that opera?
It's still very personal, although this is a Greek librette out of the Greek mythology. It still is human, with human sentiments.
Why do you think more than the Countess? Now, why more
yes.
than the Countess? What is lacking in the Countess as a human character, do you think?
Strauss didn't want to write a human drama or a human comedy. He wanted to write a discussion on art. The various principles in art are put into a personal shape. Let us say the Count, for instance, who is the amateur, the gifted amateur, whom we know all too well, all of us, you know, who's very proud if he can take part and recite the poem, and he recites it terribly awful, and the poor theater director has to make a good face to all of them. We all have to say it's wonderful, only the Countess, who knows that her brother really has no musical talent whatsoever, she's terribly embarrassed, because she has the real artistic taste to know that what the amateur does isn't the real thing. She knows that the people like Clairon, who is a great maîtresse of her art, who is really one great actress, yes, she has the greatest respect for her, and everybody sees, for instance, that poor Count, who after all pays and gives the money and so has to be respected and has to be allowed to speak those lines if he wants to, but nobody takes him serious. There you are.
What about the Countess's last scene? The music changes then. You suddenly have a lyrical outpouring at the end.
Yes, now Strauss, I don't think, would have ever done without any lyrical outpouring of a soprano voice. You can count on that, there's coming something very spectacular and very beautiful, and that's what it is. I think, quite honestly, there's some more human emotion in it than in the other opera, because there the discussion is no longer between the other people, but it takes place within the heart and the head of the Countess. But since it isn't solved, you can see that it isn't really a person, because a person would solve it. A woman. Oh, yes. I think the last word has Strauss himself in the postlude with the music, where he decides that, after all, he, Strauss, decides music is more important than words. That wonderful last page of the orchestra and the beautiful interlude just before the Countess enters, there is Strauss's decision quite clearly, although it isn't said, and he would have never said it.
Well, then the Countess goes in after that enigmatic greeting, salutation to herself in the mirror. Then she goes in for dinner. What do you think? How do you play that?
Do you
that,
know that the theme for the dinner when she goes off is a very famous German song called Freut euch des Lebens, Freut euch des Lebens. Yes, you enjoy your life. That's what. Oh, there are many quotations. If the public only knew how many quotations are in that opera, commentary of the orchestra to as to what is being said and done on stage is so witty and so full of the most marvelous musical associations. But of course, that's something one would have to study with a score and with record movie and really from
the Daphne and the Ariadne quotations, I think, are fairly obvious to
yes,
people.
Yes, but there's, for instance, one quotation when I talk about my brother, who isn't very musical, and I say he prefers Einzugsmärsche, which is what do you call that in English? Marches, well, and there comes
military
the
music.
Yeah, yeah, and there comes the short Aida theme. Bam, da da dam, bam, bam, bam. In another, not in this rhythm, but it is there. And so many of those things. When he talks, for instance, about the blasse Ästheten, about the bloodless aesthetics, that's it. He quotes his great, I can't say enemy, but the person who was really against him all his life, Pfitzner. You see? It's a quotation from Pfitzner there. Mozart, and he quotes all kinds. Not only Gluck and Handel.
Well, what difficulty, then, does this role present to you that the other roles that you sing of Strauss do not?
In the first place, the role is very difficult to sing. And the difficulty, really, is to sing it beautifully, but at the same time pronounce it very, very clearly, which, over this orchestra, is not easy at all. And that is a technical difficulty, which has to be solved, of course, by everybody. And I think the difficulty is to forget that the audience might not understand it. You have to tell yourself, I play it as good as I can, I sing it as good as I can, and I have to think that the audience will get it. And I think they will. The action really is in the heads of the people. It is thinking most of the time. And that's what you have to make visible, that people are trying to follow an argument and trying to digest that in their own heads, try and follow the next argument, throw another argument in, answer it quickly or slowly. There comes the difficulty, that you haven't got to know what a person said before. Well, that comes in every opera that's like that, but in this opera it's more than ever that you have to not know what somebody is going to say and try and digest it in your head. It's not easy, those thoughts, to really think them over and then answer. Now, we have to find some kind of medium where the public still grasps some meaning as to what's being said. And I think Mr. Hager has found a very good solution there in making some of the things visible in the background. For instance, the great monologue of the theater director, which is the most wonderful, wise, and witty thing, where he makes some things visible in the background by little props and so on. And also, for instance, the ballet, which is usually danced only by two dancers, is now being augmented by some other dancers and so on. So some things are being made visible which otherwise would just be left to the audience who would understand the words. Strauss goes through all the musical forms possible. He goes from the monologue via the duet to the greatest fugue ever written. It's a fantastic thing. This, unfortunately, we have to cut some of that fugue because it would really be too long. It is even cut in the German theaters, you see. But still the form is preserved. And some of the ensembles are so intricate that really, I must say, I've done many things in life, but they are very, very difficult to do well. I think, and I follow there somebody who has said some very wise thing, and there's none less than Otto Klemperer, who said even he, with his ear, cannot follow more than three lines in a fugue or an ensemble at the same time. So you can perhaps follow three sentences being said at the same time or in the way of a fugue, but not really much more than that. Well, there comes the work of the audience. They would have to read the libretto beforehand. Then I think they will have much more of it. And I think it is a libretto worth reading and studying because there are so many themes for somebody interested in opera as such that you can have conversations for years to come from that one libretto.
These essential questions are raised in the Countess's first scene. She and her brother, the Count, discuss them after having listened to Flamand's sextet. The masterly translation of Clemens Krauss's libretto here is by Walter Legg. The Count speaks. Don't mock, sister. You have two suitors. Words or music, to which are you inclined? Countess. I do not want to think, only to listen and enjoy. Count. Your ladyship, where does this road lead? Countess. Yours, my lord, leads to adventure. Count. Today a gracious glance for the one, tomorrow a smile of favour for the other. Countess. The call of the spirit echoes in my heart. Count. The poet woos more ardently. Countess. Mind your own business, you are playing with fire. Count. Only the fleeting pleases me. Countess. Who knows his fate? Count. I am curious to know which you will choose. Countess. Neither one nor t'other. Choice would mean loss. Count. Lightly lost, lightly won. Beauty of life, true prize. Countess. Painfully win, lovingly clasp. Truth of life, fairest prize. Count. Blithely decide, carefree possess. Joy of the moment, wisdom of life. Countess, gladly acknowledge, inwardly yield, moment of happiness, joy of life. The role of the Count, sung in that excerpt from the Angel recording by Eberhard Wächter, is perhaps not very important thematically. Madame Schwarzkopf pointed out that he expresses the views of the patron, the amateur, the dabbler in the arts. His opinions affect the central argument hardly at all. But for all that, he is not negligible as a character, as Thomas Stewart, who sings the role in the current San Francisco production, says.
I would go so far as to say there are no small parts in Capriccio. This is, Capriccio is one of those operas where every character is a very clearly defined one, and even though the part of the Count or even the part of Clairon, these parts could not be called a major role in the opera. And even better examples I can think of, the parts of the Italian singers, the soprano and tenor. These are such clearly defined, beautiful characterizations that the old saying about, well, he does a bit part, he does a small part in that in this particular opera. In Capriccio, this doesn't hold true. Each character is too important. All of the people are on the stage almost all the time. You may not be singing, but because of the nature of the opera, it being, in Strauss's words, a conversation piece with music, it's very important that if you're not saying lines or singing lines at a given moment, one must act and the entire atmosphere has to be maintained by every person on stage, so that it's very challenging for all members of the cast.
You always have to remember you're in that salon of a,
that's right,
of a countess,
that's
all right, the time. That's very interesting that you say that the characters are very well defined, as I believe indeed they are, because it nevertheless is an opera built upon an idea.
Yes, it's the fact that one could take out of everyday life a few hours, a passage of time of a few hours, and write an opera about it. And it's very, very interesting to me to possibly get, if I may do so, get into the character of the Count. It's very interesting that the Count at one time, of course, makes this very suggestion to the poet Olivier and the composer Flamand, that he should take the situation of Capriccio and write an opera about it. And this is actually what Capriccio is. Strauss has done this very thing. He's taken a little slice of life, a matter of a span of a few hours, and has written an opera about it.
In the thematic figuration of this opera, though, it's the Count who seems to support words.
Yes, he's very much a man for the written word. He has a soft spot in his heart, and his sister, the Countess, she remarks about he's not very musical, and he never passes up an opportunity to champion the poet and the writer. He likes music, and at one point in the opera, actually at the point where the Countess mentions the fact that he's not very musical, Strauss, in his own inimitable way, has brought into the orchestra a slight military march theme at that moment to imply that this is the sort of music that the Count goes for. I mean, that he likes is military music, and it's very interesting. These are, of course, these are small, fine points that I suppose a lot of times is missed on the part of the public, but studying and working and singing in the opera, finding these things make it doubly interesting.
Illumine the character, but the opera, this opera, of course, is full of references of that kind.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There are references to Elektra in a number of places, and let's see, I believe to Salome, Strauss. He brings in so many of, and to Daphne, if I'm not mistaken, in thematically, when not musically thematically, but he refers his characters, the characters in Capriccio refer to certain operas or certain situations that so clearly come from another opera of Strauss, in many cases another opera of Strauss.
And when they decide about Ariadne auf Naxos.
That's right.
They don't want an opera like that, there's a reference to it. Well, what is the Count's view? Why is the Count's view of La Roche's plans as derisive as the other people?
Well, I think the Count, he doesn't look down upon La Roche, but he feels that he's so deeply entrenched in the old school, the old art of performing, the performing arts, in this on a grand scale, in a grand manner. Of course, everyone picks up this theme, then Olivier and Flamand, they really began to tease him about this, but the Count, he scoffs at the whole thing because of La Roche, he stresses the importance and the beauty of the Italian bel canto, and this the Count has no use for whatsoever. He would much prefer a nice, strong drama, and he speaks about in opera his beautiful, his pet. The words are so often covered by the orchestra or the singers, they can't speak the words clearly enough to understand them, and it's really, it doesn't matter what the librettist has written, because the people can't understand what's being said.
He seems to be a kind of Philistine in some ways, and that reference to military music in the orchestra would tend to substantiate that, except that if he is a Philistine, he's a very elegant, very cultivated Philistine indeed, and
well,
only
yes,
on the subject of
he
opera.
He is taking the period of Capriccio, and of course any nobleman of that time, in order to be considered a nobleman, and in such a finer house as this one obviously was, he had a certain amount. Of course, he had a tendency to go to the theater, not so much music, but he certainly knew music from hearing. He didn't care for it, as his first line when he comes in the comes on the stage with his sister is the fact that it hurts his ears to listen to the music. But still, he has heard enough of it. I mean, he very definitely is an intellectual, and he knows music, but doesn't care for
it. And he
it.
Obviously has histrionic gifts,
yes.
too. We presume that Clairon is not merely buttering him up, that, that he does declaim well.
This is an excellent point. I really don't know. I've tried to examine the text, both of Clairon and the Count's responses to that, and the conversations between Clairon and Olivier. And I don't know. I've often asked myself, in studying the part of the Count, was he really talented, or was these compliments that Clairon talks about, were they just really, as you say, just to butter him up, or was he really talented? And I must honestly say, I have not yet come to a conclusion.
Well, I think some of it might be determined by the way the singer in question, the singer doing the part of the Graf, declaims that sonnet at the beginning.
Yes, this is another thing I have also done. I have no intention whatsoever of ever memorizing these lines, because of speaking of the sonnet, because this is impromptu. He gets the manuscript on stage at that moment, and I feel that he should never be completely free with these words, and feel that a certain amount of hesitancy and possibly bad declamation, not bad, but I try to make it as much as possible unprepared in order to bring in this element, this human element, if one may say so.
The Count is also very perceptive, isn't he? The one who sees immediately what's going on between Olivier, the Countess, and Flamand.
Oh yes. He teases his sister really quite unmercifully about it, and he knows how attractive his sister is, and also knows whether she really realizes it. He makes her aware of the fact she must choose one or the other. What is it going to be, words or music? In a sense, he almost pushes her to make the decision, and he's very deceptive. And another part in regards to his ability to see these things is when the young ballet dancer comes out to do her dance, La Roche speaks about the young ballet dancer, and he also suddenly realizes that La Roche has been something of an old gay blade himself, to suddenly find this beautiful young ballet dancer and manage to, I think he says something about he took her away from another nobleman, account of the girl was dancing somewhere else, and he suddenly realizes, oh, this old fellow here that I had almost put into the past, really maybe there's a little fire still left in him. If he could lure such a charming, beautiful young creature as this away from what was obviously a very, very nice surroundings.
Yes, he does have that enormous kind of psychological insight, and there is that wonderful scene for the Count and the Countess, a scene of lyrical expansion right at the opera that stops one from treating him, I think, too much as just a prop figure.
Yes, it should be. This, again, it's so important. Every single line that every character, this applies not only to my particular role, the part of the Count, but to everyone. There's so, Strauss has written musically and from a text standpoint, every line is so important to establish, as I mentioned before, these very clear-cut characters. And the text and the music helps so much. And it's so important that really every line is understood and is clearly defined. The relationship between the Count and the Countess, or between the Countess and the two young men, Olivier and Flamand, and the relationship between Olivier and Clairon, these are vignettes that each time they come up throughout the opera, and it's so important because each time one of these comes about, one learns more about the character. It's beautifully composed.
Has Strauss made it difficult at any point for the singer to articulate the text through the web of orchestral sound? Or?
Well, if one were to take musically, literally, what Strauss has put on paper, then it would be very difficult. But of course, there is a statement that Strauss has in the he made himself regarding Capriccio and regarding all opera. The fact that the text is so important, it is utmost. If the audience doesn't understand the text, then of course it's nothing. And therefore, I feel that any conductor must allow enough freedom in those difficult passages where either rhythmically it's too fast and there would be a chance of the text becoming garbled, or where vocally the line is makes it difficult for the text, the projection of the words. There, one must compensate for that by either slowing down in the tempo or possibly in the orchestra. If it's a beautiful line and there is text being sung on the stage that's important, then the orchestra should come down so that the singer, in the process of singing, it's hard enough for the singer to sing a long, beautiful musical phrase and make the text understood. And if he has on top of that an orchestra that's really, really playing at full force, then it's virtually impossible. And it's a matter of give and take. This is something that Strauss made very clear. In the opera, in the part of La Roche, he sings a great part of his monologue in regards to this, and his preface to the opera that Strauss wrote himself, where he accentuates the fact that the conductor should always, the voice, always first and foremost.
The problem's really rather aggravated then in a very large opera house in front of a non-German speaking audience. Any difference of approach, you think?
I must honestly say, yes, to in reply to this, it is aggravated very much. In a big house, the intimacy of the salon, this is already a difficult problem. Then in addition to that, if the opera is done in German before a non-German speaking public, the audience, if they do not speak German, should come well prepared, should know clearly the story of Capriccio, and by reading a libretto, try to understand as much as possible what is happening at a given time. Because so much of the play in Capriccio is purely word play. I mean, there's no pantomime, other than a few specific cases, where an audience that doesn't understand German can really know what's going on. And I might say there is a wonderful recording out of Capriccio with Miss Schwarzkopf, and by listening to this, there's a libretto I'm sure along with that, an English libretto, it would make it easier for the public to understand and appreciate Capriccio.
And the San Francisco Opera this year has sent out to subscribers this booklet that detailing the story of the opera and giving some of the musical themes, so that should
be helpful. Is that so? I did not know that. That's a wonderful idea. Wonderful idea. I can only commend Mr. Adler if he's responsible for this, because it's a wonderful idea. Capriccio is not the easiest work in the world to understand, especially if the public, to repeat myself, if they do not understand German.
Clairon, the great actress by whom the Count is fascinated, is likewise less important thematically, perhaps, than she is as a character. She helps to give Strauss's ideas verisimilitude. She helps to provide the human environment in which the characters who embody Strauss's ideas about opera can flourish. Sonia Cervena, who sings the role at Glyndebourne and in San Francisco, sees Clairon in these terms, musically and dramatically.
It is not very simple musically, like every Strauss. For that reason, I love it. And also very interesting was for me that I had to say a poem, prosa, in this, as the actress Clairon. And you know, I was an actress before I went to the opera. 3 years I acted in Prague as actress, and so it was very interesting for me.
There's the moment in Capriccio where Clairon reads the sonnet, which
yes,
has officially been written by Olivier. And it actually is a French poem. It's a sonnet by Ronsard. Do you find the transition at that moment between music and speech difficult to manage convincingly?
No, I don't think so. I think it is a very interesting moment.
Because it's important to the opera that we hear the poem as a poem And then later that we hear Flamand.
As a sonnet, as a song.
This sonnet is, in effect, the axis on which the opera turns. In it, the central thematic interests of Capriccio are broached. For when Flamand sets the words of Olivier to music, the rivals have, in effect, joined battle for the heart of the Countess. For all the talk in the salon, for all the arguments about what the public wants when it goes to the theatre, for all the different views about what opera should be, the debate evolves into the simple question, whose contribution to the now composed sonnet is the outstanding one? Whose contribution is the more worthy of the Countess's praise? The question, as the Countess sees, is unanswerable. You are, she tells them, irrevocably united in my sonnet. Flamand sings and plays the sonnet he has just set to music. Naught else there is that flames so in my heart. No, lady, naught there is on earth's whole face. Naught else that I could sigh for as for you, came Venus down herself to grant my will. Your eyes bespeak a woe of heavenly sweetness, and if a glance should heighten all that pain, another bliss and longing be vouchsafed me. Two glances signify then life or death. Yea, though I lived 500,000 years, save you, miraculous fair, there could not be another creature hold sway over me. Through fresh veins I must needs let flow my blood. My own with you are filled to overflowing, and new love then could find nor room nor pause. Countess, the poet's words, how bright they shine. But what he did not dream, the other perfected. Where lies the source? Did the words imply the melody? Was it already expectantly waiting, lovingly to embrace the words? Is language the womb of song, or does it come to life to be carried by her? Each lives in the other and seeks the other. Music awakens feelings which crave words. In words lies a longing for sound and music. Olivier, I knew it. He wrecks my verse. The beautiful symmetry is lost. Rhyme destroyed, sentences dismembered, arbitrarily dissected into separate syllables, into short and long-held notes. They call it phrase, these confounded composers. Who gives a thought to the sense of the text? The ear-tickling sounds, they're the winners. Lucky man, my words are the steps he mounts to easy victory. Flamand, remaining seated at the spinet and correcting his manuscript. Naught else that I could sigh for as for you, came Venus down herself to grant my will. Another creature holds sway over me. Through fresh veins I must needs let flow my blood. My own with you are filled to overflowing, and new love then could find nor room nor pause. Countess, how beautiful the words are, I hardly recognize them. How heartfelt their expression, and impetuous their urge. Now, Olivier, you are silent. You ponder. Are you not content with my criticism? Olivier, I am wondering whether the sonnet is now by him or by me. Does it belong to him or still to me? The Countess, with your permission now it is mine, a charming souvenir of this day. Flamand, it is always and only yours. Flamand, your poem's brilliance seems more radiant to me. Olivier, you steal my words and flatter the ear. Countess, fine thoughts in noble melody. I cannot think of a better alliance. And to the poet, much as you resist, dear friend, you are inseparably united in my sonnet.
Kein anderes, das mir so im Herzen lohnt. Nein, schöne, nicht auf die dieser ganzen Erde. Kein anderes, das ich so wie dich begehrte und gefahr Venus mir ein Angebot. Dein Auge beut mir himmlisch süße Not. Schlag aller Qual verwirrt.
This debate, which the Countess momentarily settles by taking possession of the sonnet, is brought up again in the final scene. There can be no mistake about its importance in Capriccio. As Hermann Prey, the Olivier of the Munich Opera and in San Francisco, remarks, it concerns one of the most important aesthetic problems that exists.
Capriccio brings up the greatest question what exists in art, that's words or music. Prima la parola, dopo la musica, oder...
Or the other way around.
Or the other way around.
Oder
Yes. And that's a question, Capriccio.
But they're also human beings. Isn't the success of the opera due to the fact that they are also, that Clemens Krauss and Strauss together created human beings? Think of the role you play, Olivier, the young poet.
The young poet who writes
for the theatre. You have an intrigue in just finished with Clairon,
Yes. You know, you mean they must be characters. Yes, that's true. That's true. And so Olivier is a little bit dangerous man for the Countess, I think, for my opinion. The Countess is a little bit afraid of him, and Flamand is a lyric person more. He is and Träumer, a dreamer.
Yes.
And
because so the interesting thing is that in the beginning, she listens to what Flamand produces. She listens to that music, the sextet, with her eyes closed.
Yes.
But she listens to what Olivier produces with her eyes open.
Yes, that's true. And in the end, she sings, and that is so nice that both men together, as what they do, here the writer and there the composer, she asks them to write an opera. In other words, to combine words and music.
Is she, do you think, evading the question of love? Flamand loves her and he wants her to give him an answer. Olivier loves her, wants an answer from her. And she says, well, I can't make up my mind, so write an opera together. She's evading answering.
Yes, the Countess make no decision. Whom she gives her heart. You know, and therefore I think it's no real story. It ends with a question mark.
If, as Madame Schwarzkopf said, Strauss has, without being of course explicit about it, given the prize to music in his and Krauss's contest between Wort und Ton, has he not at this juncture also endowed this muse, this mediator between two rival points of view, with radiant humanity? It is true, of course, that the Countess shows no development, that she is the same at the end as she is when she first enters. But that is perhaps only true dramatically. As she stands first in the moonlight, then in the candlelit salon before going into dinner, looking upon her own image, trying to decide what can never be decided, does she not develop? Does she not grow in awareness? Does she not see beyond the thematic problem? Is she not, in a sense, transfigured? And has Strauss not achieved this by the music he has lavished upon the final scene? If music is the victor, is it not because music alone has the power to transform ideas in this way? And is there anything more sensuously beautiful, more expansively lyrical in Strauss's work than we find in this great monologue?
Die Worte, die mein Herz You have been listening to a discussion of Richard Strauss's final opera, Capriccio. The commentary was by Dale Harris, who also interviewed cast members of the San Francisco Opera production. Recorded excerpts were taken from the Angel recording of this opera, with Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, Eberhard Wächter, Nikolai Gedda, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, Hans Hotter, Christa Ludwig, and the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Wolfgang Sawallisch. The English translation of the libretto was by Walter Legg, and the program was recorded and produced by John Whiting.